Our reading this week is in Matthew chapter 10. So if you'd grab your Bible and head over there, we'll talk about that a little bit today. Actually, I think we have to grab a little bit of 9 to...
Well, like we were talking about last week, 9 kind of sets up...
Yeah, it sets the context for
what Jesus
10.
Is up to here.
Yeah, he's going to... Remember at the end of 9, he's talking to his disciples about the need for workers in the harvest as they're going around visiting all these villages. There's so much work to be done. And so really in 10, you have the answer to
he sends
that,
out workers.
That appeal. Yeah, on his end, Jesus says, I'm going to take the 12.
Right.
And I'm going to send them out. As I was thinking about this chapter, though, I pondered something that really hadn't dawned on me before, and that is how intimidating this assignment would have been for them. Because up to this point, Jesus has been the point man.
Right.
Jesus has been the one doing the teaching. Jesus has been the one working the miracles. And Jesus has been the one taking the heat from the opposition.
Right.
But now he's saying to them, as they've sort of been the guys in the background, the entourage just going along with him, now they're going to be the ones front and center who are going to be doing the teaching and working the miracles and taking the heat.
Well, he makes it explicit to them there in the middle of that teaching there about verse 24 or so. If they, you know, they in 25, if they hated me and called me Beelzebub, they're going to do the same to you.
Right. So 10 really is a preparatory session.
Yeah.
Jesus has sent him down, and it's like dad sending his kids off to college. You know, I'm going to give you a speech about what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to supposed to expect. And that's really the entire chapter is this message Jesus has for his disciples to prepare them for the mission in 9.
And what's interesting about it, David, is it's not so much the content of the teaching they're supposed to deliver. It's teaching for them. About the nature of their work, what they should expect, what's going to happen, how they're to respond, and even kind of mentally and spiritually, how they are to prepare themselves and overcome what they're about to go through as they go and do this work. It's really, you know, a teaching for them about the work they're about to go do.
Yeah, really, the only message recorded, if I'm remembering this right, is in verse 7. Go teach that the kingdom of heaven is at hand.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
and I don't know they're really given another message.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, maybe they're given forms of the Sermon on the Mount, or you know, that means go. You know, but for Matthew's the gospel's purposes, this is more about us understanding the nature of what it means to call people to discipleship and be a disciple by spreading the word.
Yeah, and so a couple of other things, I think it even narrows more tightly than just sort of a generic, here's your pep talk and some guidance for doing this work. It really narrows down to opposition. Most of this is when people start pushing back, what are you supposed to do and how are you supposed to respond to that?
Yeah, and again, you know, we're used to kind of thinking about following Jesus as a way to your best life now or a way to, have a fulfilled and prosperous life here and now, but Jesus reminds his disciples that, you know, there will be people who this will bring you into conflict with, and that shouldn't be surprising either. And again, you have to be prepared for that.
Some people probably be a little surprised about the instruction, in essence, not really to take anything along with you. Don't even bring money.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of us, that would be the most intimidating part of it.
Yeah.
Is, you know, how am I going to get along and how am I going to survive? And I think that that is exactly the point that one of the kind of the underlying messages in all of this is you're going to have to trust God.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a very important faith building exercise here. So don't take anything with you.
Right.
Just know that God will take care of you and you will be provided for. And I think by the time this is over.
Right.
Their faith would be bolstered as they saw that happen.
Right. Well, and you know, again, part of it, I think if you know, going back to what we know is, you know, the essence of the kingdom Jesus has come to both teach and declare and then establish, you know, is the fact that it's not of this world. And so even the way that you literally go about the process of proclaiming this kingdom reflects that. It is a dependence upon God out of this world, not a, you know, settling down in this world, that they are to demonstrate in the very means by which they go about doing this work.
So we start getting hints of trouble at the end of that segment as he talks about entering a city and staying in a house. And beginning of verse 12, give the house your greeting. If the house is worthy, give it your blessing. This is 13. But if it is not worthy, take back the blessing. And so you begin to get the idea, okay, now here's some rejection or hostility.
Well, verse 14 is even more explicit about that.
Yeah, right. That's where we begin to sort of get into, there's going to be some trouble along the way for you.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You know, and so it goes from just merely, you know, you're not being received or not being listened to verse 14, or verse 16 and following. You know, beware of men, for they will deliver you over the courts and flog you in their synagogues. All of a sudden goes up a notch from just, you know, nobody's going to take you home tonight, you know. And by the way, the language about truly I say you'll be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. You know, remember, Sodom and Gomorrah were the folks who did not receive the angels. And so, you know, Jesus is kind of riffing off that whole when you're sent messengers from heaven and you don't receive them. You know, there's a consequence for that. And so you think about Sodom and Gomorrah in that regard. You know, when Sodom and Gomorrah abused or attempted to abuse the angelic visitors, you know, and Jesus kind of sees that. You know, but of course, what's shocking is he's been very explicit. You're not going to the Gentiles or the Samaritans. You're going to the Jews. You're going to your fellow Jewish people on this. And so all of a sudden, you know, the paradox of the Jewish people who had been anticipating a Messiah, not wanting this kingdom that's actually being offered, is going to put them, you know, in a Sodom and Gomorrah category where you're the ones now not receiving the messengers God has sent.
And that's just not good, man.
When
Jesus starts comparing you to Sodom,
you're in a bad place.
You're in the worst place. Yeah. But you're right. He's very upfront with these guys in almost startling fashion in verses 16 through 25 about what this could come to. I thought about verse 21. You know, he kind of does trouble with the government and then even trouble with the family.
Yeah.
Brother will betray brother to death. And so you're not just talking people unhappy with what you say. Literally, you know, people are going to die over this and you're going to be hated and you're going to be persecuted. That's
right.
He warns them about that here.
Well, and later in the chapter, he comes back to that same motif about even within your family, which you thought would be a refuge or people who'd always have your back or whatever, even in difficult times. And about verse 34 and following, he comes back to the whole, a person's enemies will be those of his own household. And whoever loves basically family more than me is not worthy of me. And that's where he gives maybe one of the most shocking lines of all. But, you know, and we've heard this, but this is where Matthew reports it in the way that Matthew is retelling the story, which is whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. That this is a cross to bear.
Right. Well, and so you get to 26 through 31, and what's interesting to me is after laying all that out, this kind of grim picture of the kind of stuff they're going to face, his response three times over the next few verses, verse 26 is, do not fear them. Verse 28, do not fear.
Right.
Verse 31, do not fear. And so a good exercise for you as you read this, I think, is to really pay attention to 26 through 31 and try to see why Jesus tells him not to fear. Because candidly, he's just given them from 16 to 25 some pretty good reasons to be afraid.
Right.
But then in 26, he goes back and says, I don't want you to be afraid. And I think there are reasons for that that are found here in the text. We'll let you kind of weed some of that out for yourselves there. But I think there are reasons that they could be fearless in the face of such opposition. But then he picks up at 32, too, and it's like he doubles down and says, this is what you must do. Because if in fear you fail to confess me before men, I'm not going to confess you before my Father in heaven. It's literally your own salvation that is at risk here.
Well, and I think that's something that we forget, David. You know, we can kind of tend to think of, I don't want to be religious and I don't have to think about this stuff. But the truth of the matter is, once you're alive, you can't escape this choice and what's at stake in the choice, like it or not. We can sit there and say, in the book of Acts, you know, when Paul is sent away, I'll talk to you about this at a more convenient time because, it's kind of scary and unsettling. But the fact of the matter is, we're here, and it's an inescapable choice that we're making the choice by choosing not to decide, in a sense. I mean, you either stand with Jesus or you don't. But I guess the other thing I would throw in too was, I mean, as heavy as this chapter is with, you know, kind of really warning the disciples about what they're up against and what's at stake, and not just a stake for you know, those who reject them, but what's at stake for them if they give in to the fear to stop doing what Jesus has commissioned them to do, is the fact that the chapter does end with reward, you know, some language about reward, that it's not all doom and gloom. There is a lot at stake. There is a lot to be endured potentially. But there is a reward for those who receive and those who persevere.
39 seems to be kind of the hinge point.
Yeah.
With that regard.
Right.
And it's kind of an odd verse just to read on the surface. It sounds almost counterintuitive, but if we try to preserve life, and I don't think that just means to try to avoid being put to death. But if we try to preserve life as we want it to be, we're going to end up losing it.
Right.
And he says it's the person that loses his life for my sake that will find it. And that's, I think that's a great way of expressing the all-inclusiveness of this. There isn't any part of your life that isn't messed with by Jesus.
Right.
And so I got to be willing to put it all on the line, right? That's what he's calling us to do with the promise, yeah, but I'm going to give you real.
Right, right. And that's the thing, is you're actually going from the lesser to the greater. You lose this life anyways, because we all die.
Well, that's exactly right. That is the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what he was teaching in the Sermon on the Mount,
right.
that you're not really going to hold on to this stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And so why are you giving yourself over to it?
Why are you spiritually compromising, you know, either in how you live or, you know, in your spiritual compromises with the world, or even just in your failure to serve the King proactively in a positive way, when, you know, again, when we keep nothing, we have nothing, death strips it all in the end.
Yep.
Why not pursue the life that cannot be taken away, that's given as a reward and a gift in the end forever?
Well, which is exactly what he says in verse 28.
And that's right.
You know, you're going to, you don't fear the guy that can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul.
Yeah.
That's not where your fear ought to be. I wonder if underneath all of this, kind of circling back to something we said at the beginning, is Jesus training them to trust.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, this is really about building a faith that is rock solid.
Right.
That isn't going to be tested in the good times. This is the faith that when the storm comes,
yeah,
is going to be, going back to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, this is the faith that can withstand the storm because it's rooted in him and not in temporal things.
Right. Or even back to, you know, the one of the great miracles Jesus worked a couple weeks ago in chapter 8, you know, which is the stilling of the literal storm.
Yes.
And an O ye of little faith, you know, just, you know, and why were you afraid, he says to them at that point too. I mean, that's the whole thing, is you're worried about losing this life.
Right.
And you also don't realize who you're with and what he's capable of, both in terms of his power over this storm, but his power beyond this world.
Yeah, God's purposes will be thwarted by the weather he created.
That's exactly
of
right.
That situation. Yes. So I want to encourage you to think about this issue of trust as you read this text with your kids. I think one of the most important things we can instill within our children is the capacity to put their trust in God, to know that his promises are true, that he's a good and loving God who will deliver on those promises. And this has got a good opportunity in this text to talk about the need to put our trust in God. Why don't you ponder talking to your kids about that this week as you work through the reading?